Mr. Winston, Reel 6.
That's something I was wondering about, in fact. Was it difficult for you to decide to leave that school when you could perhaps have gotten exemption and continued to do your good
I
work
refused,
by teaching?
I was given exemption, you see. When you were, when I was deemed a political prisoner, though that word didn't fit me in the least, I'm not political in any way. I wish I were sometime, because, but that may come later. But I refused it. When I'd served and was far from well at Wormwood for about 2 months solitary confinement, the tribunal came along and said, "Aren't you playing the fool? You could be teaching now, you could be useful, you could... an exemption," and then he was intimate. I do, there you can put it down, because I don't mind you writing it. He said, "You can say you're doing land work, or do say you're doing baking or some old thing, but you'll go on with your own interests. We beg of you, we don't want people like you to go through what you're going to. These places are not made for you, and England isn't a persecuting country, it isn't." And I agreed. I said, it doesn't fit, really, doesn't fit England to do this kind of thing, because I was more or less a minor person in prison. There were people I knew. I mean, there was Brockway just by me, Clifford Allen, both of whom became lords later on, and a whole host of people whom I more or less worshipped. I loved them. And they were all going through it, and I saw them with mouths open and feeling completely smashed and broken. One of mine, a Cambridge friend, just fell to bits, started howling. So it didn't. They were right. I said to them, "It doesn't fit, but I feel that this is the time when people should treat war as they've treated cannibalism, no more. No more war, because it's wrong." At this point, I gave them a little lecture, because one of my heroes at that time was Bernard Shaw, who seemed so very far from me, though he told people we became very intimate friends, and for very many years. Mrs. Winston did his portrait, and he wrote a book, a pamphlet I mentioned before, called The Common Sense of the War. And I said to them, "You see, at first a war is glorified, then there's a revulsion to war, and somebody comes along and talks common sense. After the emotional reaction, then somebody sits down and writes and calls it common sense. That's the point when it's called common sense, when it means that that's the end of war. People feel a kind of moral sense of it." And Shaw has written this Common Sense, which is, I think, a beautiful pamphlet. I wrote to him then how grateful the younger people must be to him. The Common Sense, I say, that happens in every possible movement. Socialism, first of all, there's terrible indignation. Then afterwards, they find that capitalism produces such unequal wealth and poverty and the exploitation, and that somebody writes a book, The Common Sense, like Karl Marx. He could have called it The Common Sense of Socialism. And then, they said that book will have no effect on anybody. It was a chap, I think McLean or so, I forget his name, he was a Liberal MP in those days. He came along. He said, that kind of, who reads? It's some little advanced, fewer sophisticated intellectuals who read it, but the mass of the people won't touch that kind of thing. I said, but it represents the mass of the people, the inarticulate mass. The sophisticated people do their own thinking, and it'll reach. And I said, it won't be many years before the socialist movement and labour movement and all the rest of it will declare against war, will outlaw war, and it'll be so in every country. Oh, no. Years later, there was a peace conference here in the Geological Museum, where the British government was all the chief foreign ministers of all the countries came. Litvinov represented Russia. Ranse MacDonald was prime minister then. He represented England. But all the foreign ministers were here, and they chose the Geological Museum, a new museum at that time, in Kensington, where they had their conference. And I was editing a paper then. I received a phone call. Would I take the Russian ambassador's wife and Litvinov's wife to Oxford to see the Midsummer Night's Dream? So that was already, as you know, after the Russian Revolution, when Litvinov was foreign minister for Russia. Well, there's Litvinov saying, I only brought it in to show how a thing percolates, that peace is indivisible. And he was making a plea for universal disarmament. And he believed it. I knew Litvinov. I say they... I was the two Russian ladies, very very handsome ones, came along in their limousines, Rolls Royces. One thing about the Russians, they play the bourgeois game much better than the English person, you know. And they came along, and we drove down. Rather interesting, connecting with another thing. I said, where shall I meet you? They said, think of a hotel. It must be a nice hotel where we can meet. So I chose the Athenaeum just by Green Park, you know, the hotel. I said, you be there and I'll come along, or I'll be earlier anyhow. So they were waiting when I came along. That's the Russian ambassador, Mrs. Maisky, and Mrs. Litvinov were waiting there, both young people. And I came along, and I said, I think we ought to go now. So the waiter came along and said, you can't go unless you have something here. We're not going to make this the meeting place of any old body who's waiting for a train to catch. Came along like that. He said, any nobody who's waiting for a train to catch. So I said, is Mr. Bracewell Smith about? Will you tell him that I'm down here? So Bracewell Smith came down. He was the owner of it by that time. He was the owner. And I said, Mrs. Maisky, the wife of the Russian ambassador, Mrs. Litvinov, and he didn't quite know whether to cut them dead, because he was a rabid Tory. And he agreed, so we got off without drinking, you know. And there were the cars outside with their chauffeurs. So I said to Mrs. Litvinov, isn't it funny? Here am I, a stranger, a bit of a stranger to England, but not much. And here are you come along. And yet, at this particular moment, Russia is fearing an English invasion and arming itself to the teeth, and we are also fearing Russian military influence, and there may be a war. Here's Litvinov, your husband, who talks the loveliest English and pleading with them, and yet there seems almost an inevitability about war. So she said, oh, don't talk about war. I'm sick and tired of it. Do you know what I think? They called me Inca. That was the pet name, Inca. That if Russia went to fight, the Russian people would refuse to do it. And she said, I think, from what I hear, that the English people would refuse to fight. I think we've reached the point where Maxim, that's her husband, Maxim feels the same, that they daren't start another war. Well, then we went to the Worcester College, Oxford, and we saw the Midsummer Night's Dream produced by a German, Max Reinhardt, one of the finest producers the world's known. They're doing this Midsummer Night's Dream. And just when there was the poem about the moon itself from behind the trees came up. Yes. And, well, Peter, Claire went down to tell you to go out, and then you bring up Claire. Say, Claire, come up, come on. You go up and bring Claire along. Go on, do. Well, so I took part, and I said that I knew Tolstoy and many of his friends. And the thing that Tolstoy would have done, given all his time to at this particular moment, is to stop the oncoming war between England and Germany.
And this was 1910 or so?
1910, I was 18. And my supervisor was Sidney Webb. And he said to me, you know, he lisped and had his little thumbs in his waistcoat pockets. He said, was it necessary for you to talk like that? I want to warn you that the thing that causes a war is preliminary gossip about it. And if you start saying that, they won't listen to this trying to stop it. They'll say, oh, it's coming on. We must start preparing straight away. So I want to warn you. So I said, I was only giving an opinion. And if all people started thinking about it, I think that an unthinkable thing like war... I said, we differ there. Well, he said, and then I said to him, the fault with you Fabians is that you're interested in home affairs, in poor law, and and cooperative movements, but you have no knowledge of foreign affairs, and it'll come upon you suddenly, and you'll find yourself wondering why you didn't even see a thing that was staring at you.